Marshall here. Welcome to RE Something Interesting, the Realignment's new weekend show focused on work and ideas that fall a bit outside the Realignment's weekly focus on policy and politics, but can still help us better understand the world around us. Today, I'm speaking with Georgia Tech sports history professor Johnny Smith about his new book, Jumpman, The Making and Meaning of Michael Jordan, which, unlike a bunch of the other great Michael Jordan bios people have probably read, looks at his career during the 1990-1991 championship season through the lens of race and culture in the America of the 1990s. I was actually born the year after the season, so I'm just really interested in looking back at the 80s and 90s through this lens, especially because it's been long enough that it's going to feel like a whole other world with totally shifting dynamics in every single area you could possibly imagine. If you enjoy this conversation, you can purchase Jumpman at the RE Something Interesting bookshop, and be sure to write into the Realignment with any other topics or ideas for these Saturday episodes. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Johnny Smith, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So this is part of a series I'm doing where I'm focusing on sociocultural topics beyond just typical politics, policy, history. Here is the first question that relates to your broader body of work in academic sense. What can analyzing sports, how does that sort of focus area reveal deeper realities of America and society?
Yeah, I think historically sports have been a central contested space around race and equality. You know, if we think back to the early 20th century, when Jack Johnson became the first Black heavyweight champion of the world, you know, his story is all about how he fought and resisted the color line in America. And so I think, you know, one of the themes of my courses at Georgia Tech, when I teach courses on the history of sports, or the history of African-American athletes, is I try to show them how our sports are inherently political, and they have been for decades. And so I think there's a lot of value in thinking about how sports not only reflect our society, but how the people involved in them actively shape our culture and our politics and social debates. And so I think that you give numerous examples. You know, I was saying the other day in another interview, again, talking about boxing, there's a great scholar, Gerald Early, who teaches at Washington University in St. Louis. And he said once that, you know, you can make the case the three most important Black men in the 20th century were all boxers: Jack Johnson, Joe Louis, and Muhammad Ali. And of course, you can argue with him about that. But I think the point he's trying to make is that each of those boxers, their life stories serve as a prism for the larger racial tensions in America, how each of them fought against the color line in different ways at different moments, but also how they became these important political symbols. And so that's the kind of work that I try to do in my classes and in my writing, is to think a little bit more deeply about how athletes, sporting events have played a crucial role, not just in sports history, but in American history. And so I think that's a role that Jordan plays that hasn't really been acknowledged. I think he's often seen as a great basketball player who've influenced popular culture, but I wanted to step back and think about him in a historical context, in terms of how he shaped his times as much as he was a reflection of the age of the late 80s and 1990s.
Yeah, so something I'm curious about, and this is why I just think sports in general as a category are going to grow in importance when it comes to analyzing America socioculturally, because they are just this last remaining center where basically everyone in the country is going to operate. Like, for example, we're not watching NBC, ABC, CBS in the same way. Like, you're never going to see a world where CNN or MSNBC or Fox are able to get the ratings that they had back in the 80s and 90s, because at the end of the day, like, we've just niched down as a society, and sports is just this one category that by its very nature, it's this like central, like, kind of like arena for society. So I'd love you to kind of just like talk about that, because that's a big difference between 1990s America and then just the America of the 2020s.
Yeah, you're spot on. I mean, I was seeing something the other day about the nightly news ratings on the three cable news networks you mentioned. And, you know, the media ecosystem is completely fractured. And the only thing I think keeping the major networks drawing viewers is really football. You know, Saturdays and Sundays, that's what's drawing eyes to CBS and NBC. And so, but even like Thursday Night Football now, I think it's on Amazon, right? Like, I mean, that's a decade ago, that would have been unheard of, unimaginable. So, to your point, you know, really for the network, sports are crucial. And of course, for the NBA, they're on TNT, ESPN, ABC, the WNBA as well. So, but to your larger point, I think, is that sports play this role, I think, in terms of shaping our national culture. And that, I think, is what is really different from a lot of these other segments of popular culture that are really in these silos. But sports continue to play a part in our national culture. I often try to talk to students about how sports continues to serve as the common thread in the fabric of American culture. It brings us together, it ties us together, so to speak. And so I think that is really important. Now, it's going to be interesting, I think, in the coming decades to see how people consume sports in different ways. Does it hold together in the ways that it does now? And the media is going to play a large role in that. But I'm a historian. I look back, not so much forward. I'm not a prognosticator, but it is fascinating. We also often talk about in my class about how crucial television is in shaping American sports. And in the book, when writing about Jordan and the NBA and Nike, I make this point that what's really important in terms of the commercial growth for the league and for Nike and for Jordan as a spokesman, it's technology. It's cable arriving really in the 80s, taking off in the 80s, and the satellite age. And of course, you have at the end of the Cold War, new markets opening up overseas. That's good for the NBA to broadcast more games. That's good for Nike for entering more markets. And of course, that's good for Jordan to sell more shoes. So all of those factors play a role in thinking about the relationship between media, television, and sports. And I think it's interesting to kind of think about those changes over time.
You know, something, last question about the broad meta picture before we get into Jordan more specifically. This isn't a future-facing question, so I'm asking you about the present. As sports remains, and this also applies, I think, to like music, it's telling that like Taylor Swift just got Time Magazine's Person of the Year the same day we're recording this. As we lose shared spaces, with the exception then of like national sports, especially football, and then like let's say like the specific space that Taylor Swift fills, how do you think that's going to shape the responsibilities and expectations that these figures like Michael Jordan and Taylor Swift have? Because my favorite thing, because I actually just work in politics, so my kind of like pushback and defense of Michael Jordan when it comes to the 1990 lack of endorsement for the Senate, but you know, Black Senate candidate in North Carolina, is that like end of the day, it's unclear if they would have made any difference at all. Like that is just kind of like, to a certain degree, it's kind of a morality play. I haven't seen any evidence that, oh, it was just like this close, and if Michael Jordan had turned out those extra 10,000. Now, and once again, it's not that it doesn't matter, but it's morality play. But today, in today's culture, clearly, and you kind of saw this in the Tennessee Senate race in 2018, Taylor Swift coming out against Marsha Blackburn could have meant something, and she's only gotten more powerful since then. So these figures, in contrast to other areas that were much more relevant in the 1990s, have just gotten so much power, more power. You could really say to somebody, no, this would make a huge difference. What do you think about that shift in the dynamic?
Yeah, it's an interesting example with Taylor Swift. I may get the figure wrong, but I think it was within the last year, she said something about registering to vote. And I think, like, in just a very short period of time, 35,000 Swifties registered to vote. And so, you know, that's great, right? She's encouraging Democratic participation, whether or not you agree with her views or whatever. But, you know, she is, as you say, using her cultural influence in political ways. And so I think that speaks to also the enormous platform that she enjoys, and that some of these other celebrities, whether they're in sports or music or Hollywood, I think they're going to continue to have that influence. Now, I don't know whether or not they will use it. I think that depends on a variety of factors. You know, I was asked in another interview the other day about, you know, comparing eras of Black athletes' political activism from the 60s to the more recent years. And even already, you'll see here in 2023 that there's a sort of retrenchment from, NBA players, NFL players, sort of, I think maybe for many of them, they feel like they've said to what they have to say about racial inequality and police brutality. But now you don't hear it quite as much, right? It's not like we still see NFL players kneeling during the national anthem. We don't see NBA players or WNBA players wearing the I Can't Breathe t-shirts. So, my point is that oftentimes athletes who have been politically active, they follow the social movements. They're connected to those movements. It's not as if that they're the ones taking the lead. They often find activism through sport or through something larger, a grassroots movement, as we saw in the 60s with the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Power Movement, and more recently with the Black Lives Matter movement. And so what might, I'm coming back to this point about Taylor Swift or LeBron James or whoever we want to name. What are they going to be responding to, right? In terms of whether it's voting rights, threats to our democracy, however you want to frame that discussion, how will they respond to it? It's going to be interesting. Obviously, we have a presidential election coming up to see how they weigh in, how they use their platform. I think it's a very interesting subject to explore.
So I think the first like ultra Jordan specific question would be the following. So you're focusing on Jordan, the Bulls, that like broader America in like 1990 to 1991, like the the championship season. And something I'm curious about, whenever you go through the Jordan storyline, especially if you're watching The Last Dance, you're going to see kind of like two examples of that I think most people who like follow this could kind of cite as these like motivations for his greatness. So one, you're going to have like the example of his father kind of like dismissing him, go back into the house where like where the women are, you're not like capable, and that's sort of like driving him. And then like specifically like David Halberstam and Rowan Lazenby and Michael Jordan Life like tell that story like very specifically, and Jordan tells the story that way too. And then secondly, there's the making the JV team rather than the varsity team. What is not focused on in either of those stories or in the popular imagination is a racial dynamic and a racial motivation. So to what degree do we know specifically how did coming of age in North Carolina in the South in the 70s and 80s actually influence his like rise to greatness? Because once again, these other accounts, and this is why yours is valuable, just haven't focused on that part of the story.
Yeah, thanks for that question and observation. That was really important to me to try to understand that part of the story, because in reading the reporting by journalists, mostly white journalists who covered Jordan's career in the 80s and 90s, that was not really an area that they covered. They didn't ask Michael a lot about it, so there's not a lot of primary source material to get the answer to this question. But I found just enough that I think pointed us and sort of some clues about how Jordan responded to growing up in Wilmington. So let's think about a couple of things. First off, in the 70s, when Jordan's growing up in Wilmington, it's a seaport town, but where he lives, it's really like the country. He grows up in kind of, and his family, his extended family's in these rural outskirts of Wilmington. And so his friends would say, Michael was a country kid. And I think that is something that's often overlooked, is that he is someone who really believes in individualism, that self-reliance is crucial to his identity. And I think that is shaped by his world in rural Wilmington. So that's part of it.
Wait,
The other,
let's pause there real quick because
yeah.
this is really fascinating. Because you talk about this like later in the book, but like at a key level, Michael Jordan's childhood and frame of reference is not that of an urban black person, right? Like think of like the Great Migration in the early 20th century. Like you're a sharecropper, you're escaping Jim Crow, and you move to Chicago, you move to New York, you move to these places where a variety of serious racial issues emerge. There are obviously huge issues of race in Wilmington, in the sharecropping South, but they're actually just deeply different than those facing urban Black people in the North. So just kind of conceptualizing that, like at a core level, there are these variety, because the post 60s, you know this, like the post 60s racial America story is just not told from this descendant of sharecropper perspective, at least in the way we would think of like the NBA or urban blight, or like kind of like how exactly did the legacy of the 60s not translate perfectly to educational outcomes. So I think that's just such an interesting conception to have.
Yeah. And so I think on the other side of that, to your point, is that when he goes to high school, the city is going through the consequences of a forced busing court order. Laney High School, I believe, is a relatively new high school. It was an integrated high school. The point being, you know, there's real racial tension there. There are some white kids who resent going to school with black kids, and maybe they pick that up from their parents or relatives who are like, you know, we don't want you going to school with, you know, those black kids from their side of town. And Michael points to a couple episodes when he's about 14 years old, where some white kids, nasty kids, hurl the N-word at him. And it forces him really to confront racism for the first time. And it makes him angry. And, you know, Michael says very briefly in The Last Dance, I mean, it happens in a split second where he says this, that he made this decision that sports was going to be what got him out of Wilmington. And if you look back at some of the comments he made when he was a player, and you look at what he says in The Last Dance, and you put them together, what you can see is that as a black teenager, he's got this anger and he doesn't know what to do with it. But the one space where no one is telling him that he is the N-word, which is essentially telling a black person that they are in fact inferior, is sports. It's on the basketball court that he is going to prove that he is the best. Nobody is going to make him feel less than. And I think that maybe Jordan wouldn't articulate it in quite the same way that I am, but that is my interpretation in thinking about the context of his life and his journey in North Carolina. And I just think that we cannot separate those conditions in Wilmington and the conditions that his ancestors faced as sharecroppers, as you noted, from shaping his journey. And I think that that is something that's really crucial in understanding Jordan's ascendance. But also, again, if we're thinking back to the other point that we were discussing, you know, he doesn't grow up in the urban North. He doesn't ever feel this sense of connection to civil rights organizations that are mostly, by that time, you know, you think of Chicago, right, where he plays Jesse Jackson, Operation Push. He has no connection to that, none whatsoever. And so I think that there's always going to be this tension between where he came from and where he was in the 80s and 90s in Chicago and being positioned as this national figure. And for him trying to wrestle with, you know, what is my role as this prominent black athlete to the black community? At any rate, we can get into that some more, but those are some thoughts I have about his youth.
And the reason why I'm so motivated by the racial question, because we're obviously going to get into kind of like the positive and negative of Michael Jordan becoming this like racially transcendent figure in the 1990s and like the broader question of how sustainable that kind of broad societal optimism was. But I'm just so drawn to this question of how does race motivate athletes of this era? Because I read Jeff Perlstein's Bo Jackson bio that came out last year, like really great bio. I'm really, like, really recommend it for folks. But there is this quick aside that I thought was fascinating, where he talks about how when Bo Jackson was at Auburn, he's obviously this incredible athlete, football, baseball, like he's, you know, track. He's like this three sport athlete. He's obviously dominant. These are like the integrated post 60s sports teams, right, in the South. A rumor went around that he was kind of like just making out with white women. And even in the 80s, his white teammates confronted him about it. And it's just like a quick aside in the book. But for me, you know, this is the whole like the past is a foreign country thing. It's incredible to me that in fear, and this is where the meritocracy thing becomes so awkward, and why your point about like how the actual sports field is just like this one space where these rules don't apply. It's wild that inferior athletes would have the audacity to walk up to him in the 80s and say, hey, by the way, like, it's great that we're teammates, we love you, Bo, but you got to cut off these rumors because we're gonna have to do something about it. And I just wonder, and I, once again, like, there's a limit to, and once again, it's telling that there wasn't like a Bo Jackson follow-up quote on that incident. This goes to your point about how like journalism of the time isn't going to explore these questions as much. I could just imagine how that happening would just, like, let me put it this way. We could come up with all these little, like, convenient stories of, like, you know, this one time Michael was told to go inside his house, and that just drove him for the next 20 years. I feel as if, like, the actual example of, like, the N-word when you're 14 playing basketball, or being told by white people that, like, no matter how good you are at sports, you cannot, like, talk to white women in a sexual manner, that would seem to be so much more motivating from a pure, like, core of your human being perspective than kind of like those, like, you know, ESPN ready kind of anecdotes. But I'd just love to hear what you think about that, because that was just an immediate reaction that I had.
Yeah, thanks for sharing the Bo Jackson story. I wasn't familiar with it, but I'm also not surprised by it. I think it's a reminder that even during the 80s, which was not that long ago, there still were these boundaries that Black athletes could not cross, even if they were the stars of a big time college football program, even if they were an emerging NBA star like young Michael Jordan. And so they were unquestionably aware of this, that especially for both of them, who would go on to have very lucrative endorsement deals, both with Nike, that they had to make choices about how they presented themselves, to your point, not just publicly, but even in-house within organizations, within sporting organizations. Not so much with Nike. We can talk about Nike's role. Nike under Phil Knight, of course, embraced this kind of rebelliousness to a degree. But I think about these boundaries, and that Jordan was very aware of them. It's why he said things in the 80s when he's trying to figure out, you know, how am I going to answer questions around race, that I don't want you to see me as Black or white. In other words, he doesn't want the public to think about the fact that he is a young Black man, because he knows the history of America. He knows the history of the NBA. If you think about the early 80s, which I write about in the book, that the NBA was stigmatized, particularly by executives on Madison Avenue, who told the league's officials, like, we don't want anything to do with the NBA because there's all these reports, much of it unsubstantiated, that this predominantly Black league is filled with Black guys who are using cocaine, that they're lazy and that they're greedy. And all these terrible stereotypes existed into the early 80s. The NBA was struggling. About two-thirds of the league, you know, the franchises were in the red in the early 80s. So the economics are tied to these racial implications. The politics are tied to these racial implications, and the image making for Jordan as well. So he knows that it's very rare that Black NBA players at the time had their own deal with a shoemaker or McDonald's or Coca-Cola. And so he knows that he has to present himself as being quote unquote clean and wholesome and non-threatening. And it's a lesson that Bo Jackson would have to learn, and basically every other Black athlete in that period who wanted to have a career endorsing products.
You know, that anecdote you just gave there gets at why, because, you know, you've obviously seen The Last Dance, like I've seen The Last Dance. From the perspective of 2023, the section on Michael gambling just feels a little like, okay, like, what's the big deal? Okay, he definitely shouldn't have stayed out late that one time during the playoffs, but, like, what's the big deal? But it seems that given what you're describing, the gambling and the controversy is just totally off the path of the dynamic that he was successfully navigating. So it seems like that's why it was of such elevated importance, which is going to seem a little, not weird, but a little sort of Puritan when we kind of look back from today's perspective.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I was asked this question the other night at a book event in Atlanta here. And I said, well, keep in mind, there were a lot of these moralist crusaders, as you pointed out, writing in their opinion columns or on television, you know, lecturing Michael Jordan about what he should be doing or not doing. And of course, it was not advisable for him to be associating with people who had criminal records.
Like actual criminals. Like,
right, exactly.
That is the actually bad part.
Not a good idea. But of course, there's layers to this. On the one hand, it's telling this successful rich Black man what to do with his money, right? That's part of it. And that goes back to this kind of paternalism that existed in the sporting establishment, if you will, telling Michael, you know, the do's and don'ts. But on the other side, it's that the public, those who are concerned about this, and I'm not sure how many there really were, that maybe he's not the role model, right? We've built him up, we've constructed him to be the hero. And of course, being the role model means that he is someone who is supposed to be an example, not just for kids to look up to, but to other NBA players who need to behave, right? Be like Mike is not just for the kids who want to grow up to be like Jordan. It's for other Black athletes in particular. If you want to enjoy the commercial opportunities like Michael Jordan has, you got to fall in line, stay politically neutral. That's the example. But the thing that I said at this event the other day was like, I don't think the public by and large was really that concerned with his gambling because Americans love to gamble. You know, I don't think they saw it as some, like he was crossing the line in any way that was really meaningful. The money was relative. He's wealthy. You know, it's a drop in the bucket for him. And so I think in some ways it passes for the public, his fans, they're not holding it against him. There's not really some larger penalty. But for Michael, in the beginning, when the story breaks about his relationship with Slim Boulder, he is anxious. He'd always been anxious that he was going to make some grave mistake. I talk about in the preface of the book that he had these nightmares in the late 80s about, you know, he used drugs or he became an alcoholic or he robbed a bank. He did something awful in these nightmares, and it totally tarnished the way the public saw him. So, you know, it's really interesting to think about that. Like, that was his fear. And yet he did take some measure of risk in these large gambling, golfing outings with people that had shady history. But in the end, I don't think it really damaged him publicly, that is. It didn't hurt him. But I think the media's response only further hardened him because he got tired of being asked about gambling. He felt like it was invasive, it was nobody's business. And so I think that that episode really changes his relationship with the press.
You know, something I'm curious about, Michael's career is both so narratively driven, and we could so easily just take out a whiteboard and put all of these little points. So, like, you know, the 84 Summer Olympics, UNC, 1990, 1991. Okay, he's going to do baseball for a second. The big 1998 season. Okay, he's going to DC. Like, you could pick with any book you write about Michael Jordan that's not comprehensive, you could just pick any point in time. So why, if we're telling the story of race and American society, did you decide to say, okay, we're going to do that 1990, 1991 championship season?
Yeah, good question. This to me was the turning point where Jordan is forced to confront with the social and political implications of his stardom. And you see it really in 1990 first when there's this hysteria around the so-called sneaker killings, where for people who are unfamiliar, Sports Illustrated ran this cover story with a pair of Air Jordans and a gunman, you know, posing to rob someone of their sneakers. The implication being that Black inner city kids were mugging and robbing and killing other Black inner city kids for Air Jordans. And I thought that this episode really required thinking about how it affected Michael Jordan, for one. How did he respond to this? Because it was presented as a national crisis. And then the other thing that I wanted to think about with that particular story is to better understand, well, what are the origins of this story? Like, how did this begin? Why did it snowball? Why did it become a media sensation? And so I tried to engage some of that mythology. But I think it's really the beginning of when Jordan is really having to think about the fact that, you know, in the late 80s, he's being hailed for transcending race, which I think is one of the great myths about Michael Jordan. But now the tables have turned a little bit because they're asking him, well, you're supposed to be the great Black role model for these Black kids too. What do you have to say about this? And then, of course, later in 1990, Jesse Jackson and Operation Push, they organize a boycott that's largely ineffective against Nike, criticizing the company for not having enough Black executives. And so Jackson approaches Michael Jordan. Again, he's being pulled into this political conversation in 1990. So that to me is like when you start to see, oh, and of course the Jesse Helms, Harvey Gantt Senate race back in North Carolina. So you have these three really crucial events. And if you put them together and you think about how they occur over the course of really as he's beginning his journey toward that first championship, it helps explain why Jordan feels like he's under this great turmoil. You know, that in the middle of the season, at one time, he's complaining to his teammates that everybody wants a piece of me, right? That the NBA wants a piece of me, this organization, the Chicago newspapers and media, and civil rights groups now. And like he just feels like he's being pulled in all these directions. And so I felt that, you know, this was an opportunity to think about how he responds to this racial dilemma, his own racial dilemma, and the country's racial dilemma. And so it made sense to me to kind of put those pieces together and intertwine them in his journey as he's moving towards that first championship. Because by the end of that championship season, and he's experienced all of those events, that is really the moment when Jordan, I think, retreats into himself, you know, and he becomes hardened with the press because they've been asking him all these questions and he doesn't want to answer them anymore. And he's having to deal with the sort of myth-making that he helped shape. As the hero, because now it's, well, what responsibilities come with being the hero? You know, what is the obligations you have to America writ large, to the Black community? And so this is when he really has to deal with it. And so that's why I picked this time period.
Why do you say that the Michael Jordan transcending race narrative is a myth? Because, as you put it in the book, and I think this is a good way to frame it empirically, despite everything, when someone says the words Michael Jordan, they do not think Black athlete. Even with previous greats, Muhammad Ali, I'm still going to think, I say the words Muhammad Ali and like the 60s just like emerge there. Jackie Robinson, once again, like race. Michael Jordan, I think, from a pure celebrity and place in American culture perspective, I think is able to just be like this great athlete. And race is not incidental, but it's definitely secondary in a way that I'd probably argue, and I think you would may argue, would be unprecedented for a Black athlete in this country. So if that is true to a certain degree, how is it a myth that he transcended?
Well, because he has to make certain choices as a Black man and how he presents himself to the public, that he has to push aside his past battles with racism, that he cannot engage in meaningful discussions about the persistence of racism. And so he has to set aside his skin color. He tells Diane Sawyer, I should say, in 1987, I don't want you to see me as Black or white, you know, but he's Black. Right? Like this whole idea that we can erase his experiences as a Black man and that he's able to transcend his skin color in some way. That's why I would say that it is a mythology. Now, there's a history here, as I outline in the book, that you can look at previous examples of athletes who were held up as transcending race, whether it's Julius Erving, who was really Jordan's role model in a commercial space, and O.J. Simpson. Right? O.J. Simpson, who famously said, you know, I'm not Black, I'm O.J. Right? And so I think that when we think about these ideas of what it means to transcend race for prominent Black individuals, it's as much about who you are not as who you are. In other words, Jordan positions himself in some ways as someone who is not the stereotypical Black NBA player who is seen as a criminal, right? Or using drugs in all those ways. And so my point here simply is that the mythology about transcending race is rooted in these ideas where Jordan has to consciously make choices about how he presents himself as a Black person. And he intentionally didn't remind people about his experiences or how he saw the world as a Black person. It was an intentional choice. Magic Johnson, the same thing. And of course, your view of him, the way you said, you know, well, I think of Ali, I think of civil rights in the 60s. And that makes sense. I get that. But one of the reasons I wrote the book was to remind people that we couldn't divorce Jordan's stardom, his success, and that white fans, white kids loved him, from the fact that he grew up as the grandson of sharecroppers, as you mentioned at the top of the hour. So I think it's important to understand how those historical forces shaped him and the conscious choices he made about the way he presented himself. But it is interesting. I see your point too, that, you know, on the one hand, Jordan, he wrestles with this dilemma, right? I think that's really the heart of the book. On the one hand, race is important, particularly for the Black community, because he's making these breakthroughs, right? Black America sees not just who's buying the shoes, white America, but who's selling the shoes. That's a big deal. We should not overlook the fact that Michael Jordan, as an endorser, as the face of multiple international companies, no Black person ever had that opportunity and succeeded the way that Jordan did. So on the one hand, Jordan knows that it's a big deal that he's making these breakthroughs as a Black person. On the other hand, too, though, that in this point in his career in the late 80s and early 90s, there's certain segments of white America that feel like there's too much discussion about race, that it should not matter, and they don't want to think that it matters that Jordan is Black. And so I'm simply asking readers to consider the implications of the fact that his stardom as a Black hero for kids of that were Black, that were white, whatever, that it had, that it mattered in all those communities, and people interpreted him through a racial lens. I think that's the thing that I would come back to, is that for different communities, he meant different things, and we can't separate race from that conversation.
That's really interesting. And a thought I had, because this isn't a biography, obviously, but I wonder but you're obviously engaging in acts of biography.
Right.
I'm sure you've noticed this. Did you read the Tiger Woods bio that came out a few years ago?
I did not, but I'm aware of it. I know which one you're talking about. So, and then it became a documentary on HBO.
Yeah. So a key HBO. Narrative in both the book, the documentary, and frankly, The Last Dance, and most of actually the writing on these two athletes specifically. And it's telling that they come from the 1990s very specifically, is, you know, Tiger is just kind of like mysterious. Like, we can't get into his head. Michael Jordan, he's kind of mysterious. Like, this is, and with both athletes, they like the authors and people commenting on the work will specifically say, more than any other person we've like written about, or if there's been, I think one of the lines was, for all the attention that's been put into both of these people, we know very little about what they're actually thinking.
Right.
How much of that then, to what you're articulating here, is that they had to kind of be that way? In the sense that, like, how much of this is the way that you become just like this great American athlete is this like imperceptible, ethereal, opaque, stoic greatness, versus if you were a Black athlete in the 1990s with complicated, well, obviously Tiger's racial background is complicated, and then Michael Jordan's background is complicated coming from the South. Was that just inherent? I'm just curious how you would think as a writer about how you're telling that story. Because I think, once again, I think the thing that you're just kind of helping me with here is, if we just ignore the racial aspect of Michael Jordan, things that we could just sort of say, oh, it's this mysterious act of the gods, actually just become much clearer. Like, if Michael Jordan can't acknowledge this racial dilemma, he's not going to be open and is going to be mysterious. There's this entire side of him that he's not going to talk about for both personal reasons, because it's not like he just wanted to be endorsing in the Senate race. He doesn't come off that way. But also for literal commercial reasons, that's not mysterious. That's actually very understandable reality. So how would you think about this?
Yeah, I think this is a real important question about agency, you know, that Jordan makes choices. And so, you know, one example of this is that he doesn't come out and publicly endorse Harvey Gantt, but he donates to his campaign a few thousand dollars or whatever it was. And after he retires from the Bulls, he makes political contributions, right? Contributed to Barack Obama's campaign. My point being, he was not inherently apolitical, right? To your point.
Actually, quick thing, because you yeah. actually cited this, and it's a funny, fun fact. He gave to the 2004 Senate race, not the 2008 presidential campaign, which I just sort of like, that's a real, if I could get a, I'm like, I want to know what was going on there.
No idea. And when I was researching, I was like, come on, this doesn't make any sense, but that's what the record shows. So I thought that's really odd. But at any rate, you know, the point is, it's not as if he was not attuned to these conversations about elections or what's happening in America, he was. I think that, of course, as he has said, he had tunnel vision during his playing career, and he didn't want to enter into the fray, the political fray. And I try to explain why that is beyond sort of the obvious that, you know, he wanted to protect his brand. But I think the other thing to think about the 90s is that it's an era in which a lot of Americans are pulling back from community affairs. The 1996 presidential election with Bill Clinton, less than 50% of the eligible voting population turns out. You know, people are pulling back from political engagement. And so in some ways, I think Jordan and Tiger, who's just beginning to make his ascendance, you know, they reflect the times as well, you know? And so I think that's also important. And what I try to do as a historian is to think about how these athletes fit into particular eras and how those political moments shape the way they respond to the world around them. You know, you think back to, you know, Rodney King, you know, being beaten by the LAPD for the whole world to see on this grainy footage in 1991. Michael Jordan says nothing about it. Magic Johnson says nothing about it. Neither of them take any public position on it. But no other NBA players were. It was not part of the culture in the league. And the press wasn't really asking them questions about it. So it was not like it is today where, you know, you have George Floyd or something else like that happening, and NBA players will either initiate on their own and release a statement or post a statement on social media, or they'll talk openly with the press about how they feel about police brutality. So, but the reason I think that we should really think about that era as different from today is that there was not this large social movement responding to police brutality and racism in the ways that we saw in like 2015, 2016, as Black Lives Matter began and that athletes responded to it. So again, it goes back to the point I was trying to make earlier about how athletes have historically responded to these movements. They haven't been at the front of them.
You know, something I'm curious about, I like your point about how, because once again, Tiger and Michael Jordan not being particularly political, that actually matches the times. So it's different if they held their specific viewpoints during the 60s, because that's a different time. Mass mobilization isn't present. The stakes are frankly just different, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So something I'm curious about then, what do you think, or even what did Michael think he owed like the Rainbow Push Coalition in the 1990s? Because for good or for ill, Jesse Jackson could just not make the same moral claim as to stakes with the Nike boycott, or just frankly to representation. Like, I do not think that the Rainbow Push Coalition could argue that it had the kind of quasi-democratic mandate of heaven that the 1960s civil rights movement had. I think if, for example, like, once again, we're not trying to do like the unhelpful, you know, magic Negro MLK thing, but like, in all actuality, I think MLK could conceivably and justifiably sit down for Black athlete in the 1960s and say, no, like, I actually clearly represent both this community's interests. There's very little debate about this. Like, there's no debate about Jim Crow in the Black community. There's obviously a disengagement and debate around how do we respond to Nike's success in the 1990s. So how does that just shift how we should think about it? Because I just think folks should understand, as I'm like, because I listened to your audiobook, as I'm listening to the book, I'm like, these are just, it's not just that, because this is deeper than just this notion of like, oh, wait, like, come on, like shoe boycotts versus like Jim Crow. This is separate from that. Like, these are just two different organizational frameworks responding to different societal expectations.
Yeah. You know, Michael's feeling, and he was, I think, smart about this in some ways, was that, look, there's racism that exists across corporate America, right? That there's very few Black executives, period, across corporate America in this period in 1990. And Jordan's feeling was, you know, Nike is not unique in that regard. If you want to tackle that, you know, why, Reverend Jackson, are you focusing just on Nike? Well, there's an obvious answer why he's picking on Nike, because Nike gives this movement visibility, right? Making it about Nike gives the arguments visibility. So it was strategic from Jesse Jackson's point of view. But Jordan's position is, you know, I'm happy to have this conversation with the folks at Nike, but he's not going to be drawn into a public debate. And of course, the folks at Nike don't want Jordan getting drawn into a public debate. I think that made Michael very uncomfortable. He did not want to have these discussions in public because he was afraid of saying the wrong thing. Not that he didn't have opinions. I think that's the difference here, right? David Falk would say, like, oh, Michael's apolitical. I think that's dismissive of Michael Jordan, frankly. He's a smart man. He made good decisions, some that you could question, perhaps. And, you know, people would say, like, on the one hand, when you have that platform, what you say certainly matters. And you can also say that what you don't say with that platform matters, right? The silences matter. And so there are these critiques. And a lot of those critiques came from the older generation of Black activists and Black athletes. Black athletes like Jim Brown, the famous Cleveland Browns running back, Hank Aaron, the great baseball player of the Atlanta Braves, Arthur Ashe, the great tennis player. They all believed that Jordan had a larger responsibility to the Black community to use his platform in ways that few had the ability to do. And so I think that what I try to do in the book is not to judge, but to try to understand. But I would also push back on this idea that Jordan's achievements belong solely to him, right? That they are achievements, particularly, you know, his achievements in that moment, they belong to those who came before that created opportunities for him to succeed. And I think that that was something that many of his critics, like the three athletes I mentioned, they had a problem with Michael and they wanted him to do more. And but Jordan struggled under that weight. That was something that he really struggled. And he told reporters, I think it was in 1992 after the LA riots, like, I'm not a leader in this space. I'm not a political leader. There are more qualified people. But what's interesting is then I had found this other quote in 98, Jordan's last season with the Bulls, where he said that, you know, when after I retire, I can see myself becoming more involved in these discussions, but not now, not while I'm playing. Like for him, it's clear he felt like he had to separate and compartmentalize, maybe that's a better way to think about it, to compartmentalize his life. This is a man who lived in a bubble, like literally lived in a bubble in many ways. And I think it was hard for him to imagine himself outside of that bubble, having a role outside of that bubble. But then the other thing I talk about too is personality. Like Michael Jordan is someone who has got to be in control of everything. We see it on the court. He doesn't want to give up the ball. He does not want to pass the ball. He's not interested in Phil Jackson's triangle offense, right? He wants to be in control. Think about off the court, you know, guy who manicures his image. He doesn't want to give up the ball either in that sense, right? You start engaging with civil rights groups or different political groups or whatever, you got to give up the ball. And that's a vulnerable place to be. And I don't think he liked that. He wants to be at the top. He wants to be the decider. And I think it goes back to some of those points we made earlier about his southernness and self-reliance. Like his viewpoint of the world was largely, you know, you're on your own in this world. And that's the way it should be. And I think that's the way he approached life in many ways. Now, he understood charity, right? He donated to Black scholarship funds, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and other Black organizations. But I think there's also this fundamental difference between doing for a group and doing with a group. And Jordan was much more comfortable doing for others than doing with others.
So for this last section, I'm really interested in the infamous Republicans buy sneakers too quote. What's interesting about this quote is that depending on the mood of the country, the quote's either a good thing or a bad thing. So during the height of BLM and the height of Colin Kaepernick, that is very much used dismissively. Especially because this was all happening before this, so like obviously, Last Dance creates like a Mike, another like Michael hype cycle. So like, I think Michael Jordan's been, especially in 2018, was just like outside of the public mind, probably peak like outside of Michael Jordan outside of the public mind. So it's used very dismissively. It said like, look at Michael Jordan, and in the like naive 90s, he says this quote. But you know, honestly, like sitting in the year 2023, going into 2024, like I actually think that. Especially as the country is increasingly divided, the actual idea of we're going to have this space, athleticism, sports, this remaining arena where we're all kind of like hanging out, where I'm actually glad that someone's kind of thinking that way. Now, I think it'd be different if you were to extend that viewpoint into everything. But I just curious, so that's just my personal take on it, but I'm just curious how you think of like the evolution of whether or not it's like a pendulum. The pendulum swinging between like whether this is a good ideal or whether this is kind of selling out. And like it seems like we're just sort of in a weird in-between space from whether or not we're lauding or kind of dunking on it.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. It's funny too, because when I set out to write this book and I started doing the research, there was no Last Dance. So to your point, Jordan wasn't really being talked about a whole lot. He was the owner of the Charlotte Hornets. They're a mediocre franchise. And, you know, Jordan comes up when Charles Barkley is criticizing him for not putting together a playoff winner. But he's by and large kind of on the margins of the popular culture, if you will. So, but that changes, as you noted, that when you have this movement, the Take a Knee movement, if you will, with Colin Kaepernick and other African-American athletes and white allies who believe that they have to take this stand, join this movement, and Jordan becomes a foil, right, for an era when Black athletes rejected this role. But what's interesting, I think, is that there was really a continuum for Jordan going back to the 90s through his period as an owner. And that is this: he has pretty much always seen his power in economic terms. He did not identify with protest in the way that this younger generation that comes after him or the older generation that came before him. So I write in the book about these different generations and how they thought about protest in Black America. And, you know, he, as owner of the Charlotte Hornets and as the CEO of the Jordan brand at Nike, he has these incredible financial resources, and that's what he is going to do to make a difference. And he has, between really like 2016 and 2020, at these different moments, he donates large sums of money to Black organizations, the Ida B. Wells Journalism Foundation to help advance the careers of Black journalists, to historically Black colleges like Morehouse here in Atlanta and the Smithsonian's Museum for African American History and Culture and some others as well. And the point being, as Jordan says through a press release, that this is important work, right? To lift up the Black community and Black institutions to help them grow and advance in different ways. But in some ways, although some people might say, well, that's a departure from his past, again, I see it on a continuum. He's always been much more comfortable doing for than doing with, as we were talking about a moment ago. That is where he is comfortable. He has a team help him craft a statement. He released a statement. He's not going to hold a press release and talk to you directly about how he feels, even though I don't have any doubts that he had thoughts and feelings. But he's a private person. He said he gets that from his dad, and it goes back to, you know, some of these events, I think, in his youth that shaped his personality. That's a big part of this. We don't want to turn Jordan into some Wheaties cover, cereal box cover, right? Like, he's a real person, and he's complicated, and I think it's important to try to tackle these complications in ways to better understand him and his place in our culture.
You know, for the last big question or so, obviously the 1990s, in some respects, were this, we kind of look back almost, you know, 30 years later and think like, wow, there's a lot of like optimism about race and colorblindness in our country. And in many respects, it's pretty clear that we're kind of on a downswing from an optimism perspective. I'd be curious, take it to the end of the book, right? So it's 1991. Pretend we're back then. This is the year before I'm born. We're excited about the prospects for like race in America. Like, what do you think kind of went wrong at a narrative level, or what didn't? Not what did, like, what were maybe like the next steps that should have happened or could have happened that maybe would have kept us on like an upward trajectory if we're thinking about American society?
You know, one of the things I tell my students is that these ideas about progress are not linear. And so, and historical events are not inevitable. And that's why context is so important. And so I see it a little differently, maybe. I think, I think about 1989 and Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. This film that had white folks up in arms panicking that if black people and brown people went and saw this film, they were going to leave the theater so angry there are going to be riots in the streets. Of course, that didn't happen. Spike Lee, I think, was largely misunderstood in that moment. He was deliberately provocative to spark a conversation about the persistence of racism and hate and pitting one group against another or different groups against each other. And so I think that as we think about Do the Right Thing in Spike Lee, I think about the fact that, a lot of his critics, they call them some awful things. They called him a racist. They said that he hated white people because he made this film. And even I found a few instances, not a lot, but just a few, where some critics questioned Michael Jordan for making commercials with him, right? Does Michael share Spike Lee's, politics, black nationalist politics? So, my point is here is that Jordan and Lee are interconnected in this moment between the late 80s and the early 90s. Jordan stands by Spike. Nike stands by Spike. But I don't necessarily see it as a moment of optimism necessarily. I mean, I think about Rodney King. I think about the OJ case. I see that the country is continuing to tear itself apart by the seams. And so, I'm not sure that. I'm not sure, but I also see your point too that maybe for some folks, they felt like a lot of progress had been made. And indeed, but I try to point out using some polling in around 1990 that although a lot of Americans said optimistically, like black and white kids should go to the same schools, the majority of white Americans said, I would consider voting for a black presidential candidate. Black families and white families should live in the same neighborhoods. There's a lot of optimism there. But the flip side of that was polls also showed that the majority of white folks viewed black men in stereotypical terms, believing that they were more violent, more prone to be criminals, to use drugs, and to be less patriotic than white people. And so there's this real tension, right? And that's that tension that Jordan is navigating. That's really one of the main points that on the one hand, he's held up as this figure to give the country a sense of optimism. He is the American symbol of progress. On the other hand, I try to just make the case that for all the success of these black stars, whether it's Michael Jordan or Whitney Houston or Bill Cosby or Eddie Murphy or whoever you want to pick from that era, it didn't necessarily erase the way that many of these old hardened attitudes existed still. And so those troubles were beneath the surface and they explode on screen and Do the Right Thing and in LA.
I think that is an excellent place to leave things. Quick wrap-up question then. Johnny, there's been a million different books and documentaries about Michael Jordan. Which would you recommend is the best one you've kind of come across?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. The one book that was really useful to me that I read years ago, but was by Walter Lefebvre, who's a historian who has studied foreign policy, the Cold War, and he wrote this little book about Michael Jordan and globalization. And it's a really smart book, it's a thin book, and basically he was exploring Jordan in the satellite age and these international conglomerates like Nike and McDonald's and how they employed Jordan as a spokesman. And it's a fascinating way to think about Jordan. And so that's a book I would recommend if people are interested in sort of the economics behind the Jordan machine, if you will. And so that's one that I think is a good one. And I've assigned it in my classes before. So I think students have a lot to benefit from reading it.
Excellent place, Dan. Thank you for joining me on the show.
Thanks so much. Great to meet you. I really appreciate the conversation.